The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
City, it's the Gary Knoll Show, and now your host, Gary Knoll.
I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the home for independent, freedom of choice, progressive minds from all over the world. Today, we're going to take on a lot of issues from the environment. Lester Brown, we're going to talk about expanding deserts, falling water tables, and toxins driving people from their homes, and why this is important to us. We're also going to look at Africa, invasion of the land grabbers. Many U.S.-based multinational corporations and hedge funds are buying up massive chunks of Africa. To give you an idea, do you realize how large 75,000 square miles is? That's a lot of the eastern United States, and that's just part of what they've taken for themselves. What does this mean? Why would we want this land? I'll deal with that in our issue segment. My guest today, Lawrence Larry Joseph, who is an investigative journalist, and we're going to be talking about how imperiled are nuclear reactors for severe sun activity and solar flares in particular. The Carrington effect being predicted by NASA. Why? Because, well, and he'll be joined by Kevin Camps, who's a specialist in radioactive waste storage and nuclear facility operations. And we're going to talk about the recent earthquake and what it means. If we had a 5.8 that shook things around a little bit, what would happen if we had an 8 or a 9? Well, we have that, then everyone in the tri-state area will be exposed to radiation because the plants will fail. That earthquake was a wake-up call. The hurricane behind it, which was really just a tropical storm, was the co-catalyst. Imagine if that was a 7.5 earthquake followed by a 3-category hurricane. You would have absolute, complete devastation. And nothing FEMA or the state would be doing would be enough. So we're going to talk about this. It's time for a wake-up call. The latest on health and healing, including some in-depth information from Michael Anderson, Life Extension. We're going to talk about the newest science on what we can do to help us if, for example, we want more energy in our body, and most people do. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. I understand the confusion in many people's minds. Historically, we were told, have a good diet, and that's all you need. You don't need vitamins. Well, that's not true because we've never had a perfect diet. We've had good diets. Romans had good diets. Greeks had good diets. Mesopotamians and Egyptians all had good diets. And they live long lives. Those who did not suffer from poverty, those who were not injured in war, could easily expect to live healthily into their 80s or 90s, some even reaching 100. Now we have vitamins, good food, exercise and stress management, and the whole science of understanding how all this plays to our DNA. I call it the laws of compensation, and for those of you who are just listening for the first time to this, this will be a little new for you. For those of you who are already familiar, it merely reinforces it and takes a little deeper. Here's how it works. I grew up in a small community in West Virginia where almost everybody ate the same food. You had meatloaf and chicken, a roast beef generally on Sunday. It was put on before we went to church, and then it was eaten when we got back. You had fresh fruit, generally berries and apples and cherries and peaches and plums, and pears in the summertime, but rarely any other time after that. Everything else in the way of fruit was generally canned with lots of sugar. Preserves were common, but with lots of salt. And we had fast foods once a week. Rarely did we spend time in front of a television, unless it was on Sunday night when the parents and the whole family got together to watch the Ed Sullivan Show or Sid Caesar. And on Saturday mornings, it was Howdy Doody and some of those programs. But almost always, we had to do our homework. We went to bed relatively early. The kids all were exercising. We'd ride bikes or we'd run everywhere. So most of the kids I knew were wiry, thin, and healthy. What we didn't realize is that when you're young, your body has an enormous capacity for self-healing and rejuvenation. The older you get, the less that happens. And no one seemed to pay attention to virtually everyone growing up in this town went through stages of degeneration, very predictable. By the age of 30, you already had a belly, you were already, and everyone smoked, and everyone socially drank, but you didn't exercise, and there were no vitamins taken. The only vitamins ever taken were like a iron tablet, because they had been influenced by Ted Mack's Amateur Hour, and the sponsor was an iron company, Geritol. Vitamin C, we didn't take it. Growing up, as a baby, we were all given color oil. But when we moved from the farms into the cities, everything was convenience. The big thing was buying frozen foods and storing them for long periods of time. Part of that came from the fear of a nuclear war, so you wanted to be prepared. The fact that it didn't happen didn't mean you shouldn't be prepared. I remember my aunt had four freezers in her basement, all methodically labeled the foods and categorized. No one thought about enzymes or how you cook something and denaturing it. People generally did not overeat. I remember going to visit an aunt, and my brother and I, Stephen, were down there. And she had a bowl of candy on the table, and you were allowed to take one piece. If it was jelly beans, one jelly bean. But you weren't supposed to take more, so Steve and I spent the night figuring out how we could take more without them figuring it out, and we figured out the ice cream. We opened up the back of the ice cream and ate through to the front, and then they cut the ice cream. I actually saw them cutting it with a knife, little thin pieces. Everything is thin pieces. They believed in a kind of an austerity way of eating. Eat everything on your plate, but they didn't fill the plate up. So that's why so many people were thin. And thank goodness they didn't exceed a lot of calories, because that's what we now know in science will keep you alive longer when you have calorie restrictions. All those people got old and died of diabetes and cancer and heart disease and emphysema at a relatively early age. You thought you were doing well if you hit 60. 70 was just almost unheard of. Except there were people like my great aunt, who was a vegetarian, who lived alone on a farm, who raised all of these people on her farm during the 1930s. Over 40 people lived on her farm in Little Hocking, Ohio, my Aunt Myrtle. And she died in an accident, I think at 90. But no one would ever want to know what she did. They didn't like her. No one liked her. I loved her. I thought she was phenomenal because she was a disciplinarian. And she was tough. And she was no nonsense, but she was very kind. She kind of reminded me of, there was a movie with Robert Mitchum and Shelley Winters, and I think it was directed by Charles Laughton. Took place in Parkersburg, West Virginia, by the way. Or he was a preacher. Anyhow, there was a woman in there who raised orphan children and protected them. She reminded me of my aunt, and the house reminded me of what it was like to go out there and work with her. I remember at the age of 85, she was up in a tree shaking apples out. I was at the bottom collecting them all. She had the energy of no one, but no one wanted to learn what she did. All know. They'd rather sit around, play canasta, and smoke, 16,000 cigarettes, and drank 10 cups of coffee while we were given a quarter to go watch a movie. But they didn't want to do what she did. None of them did. It's like she didn't exist. And yet she had the answer. But it was an answer they weren't prepared to accept because it would mean changing the lifestyle and being uncomfortable. Once you lock yourself into a lifestyle, you can't get yourself out of that lifestyle with the biggest shoehorn in the world. We love our comforts, and anything that makes us feel uncomfortable, we reject. That's under things we even believe in. Now imagine that 85% of everything we see and hear and experience in a given day that does not align itself with our core values, we reject automatically. We don't look for the truth in it. We don't want to explore it. We don't want to research it because we're very comfortable with our truths. Whether or not they're universal truths is immaterial. There are truths. So if you're Democrat or Republican, these are your truths. So don't expect to be influenced by anyone outside. I call it the Ron Paul factor. If the Democrats wanted to stop the wars, Ron Paul would do it. None of the Democrats will. And the president won't. But it's their president, so Ron Paul's nut job in their mind, so don't vote on him. It's this kind of nonsense that goes on. And you can apply that to virtually everything that we're doing in our lives. The difference between making positive choices that would really help us at every level versus making choices that continue the problem but give us the illusion that somehow one day there will be a solution even if we're doing everything wrong. Well, if you keep jabbing a fork in your eye and you're looking for a way to heal your eye, how about putting the fork down? It never occurs to them that much of what we do in our life is self-inflicted. Environmental degradation, personal health crisis, financial collapse, we create all this. Conflicts in the world, we create it. We're not even willing to be honest about how much terrorism we actually create from the conditions of which we create in other countries. We want no responsibility for our negative actions. That's a part of our discomfort in having to face the truth of our decisions. We don't want that discomfort. We'd rather be like Bill O'Reilly. We're the best at everything. We're the best nation, the most healthy nation. We have the best of everything. No, Bill, we don't. Can you be honest for even a second? And that's where we find ourselves. So then I started seeing all these people I loved and cared for getting older, getting sicker and dire, but they thought it was normal. And the official explanation was, this is normal. So as long as the doctor was doing, if the doctor was smoking, doctor was drinking, doctor didn't tell the diabetic stop eating candy, and it was normal. Just take your insulin. So when I spent my entire adult life thus far in anti-aging medicine, I was looking at things that weren't anywhere within officially accepted science or officially accepted behavior or lifestyle. And I started seeing that even those who were in the holistic business, and by the way, let me be very clear and unequivocal on that. 80% of all the people in holistic medicine are the most opportunistic, mercenary, self-serving, selfish, egotistical people I've ever met in my life. They can help people, but boy, do you pay. You have to first go to the dentist, get any gold fillings removed, and give them their pound of flesh before they'll give you your chelation or ozone or whatever it is you're getting from them. Man, are these prima donnas. But they do some good, so we have to tolerate that. What I'd like to see some holistic nurses, doctors, dentists, chiropractors, homeopaths who are actually good people, you know, like spiritual and help people for free too. And there are some. They're just not the majority. In any case, I'll never forget one case. This is an aside. I did a show once where I talked about what a holistic doctor should charge. I believe the first visit for a full hour, including the examinations and going over the person's history, should be no more than $225. And then each subsequent visit, at least 20 minutes, no shorter than that, and possibly longer, for $150. I thought that was reasonable so that they can pay for their overhead and pay back their college loans and have some money left over for themselves, which they deserve. But that wasn't the case. One doctor in particular, you walk in his office, and I don't care if you walked in holding a severed arm, he would say, you've got hypoglycemia. Everything was hypoglycemia, and you and his wife, who if they ever make the Wizard of Oz, she'll be the one with the curled toes, the witch under the house. Man, was she bitter. I had some real strong conversations with her about how she treated people from my audience. And it didn't matter. I mean, she was like two cobras that are immune to each other's venom. It didn't matter what you said to her. She didn't care. She wanted the money. Always cash up front. $450 a visit. And poor people went to her thinking that that was the solution. In any case, I get a call, and this doctor says, Gary, you're absolutely right. We need a more spiritual approach, a more humanistic approach. We need more care and compassion within holistic medicine. It's not there now. It's very mercenary. People who call themselves holistic suddenly are charging more money. I'm going to make an example. I will be that doctor. And I had a long conversation with him, and we met. We had dinner, and I said, can you do this, this, and this for people? And he said, yes. I said, would you agree that 15% of your total practice will be free for people who can't afford anything? He said, yes. 2 months later, I get a call. Gary, you know that doctor you had on, you know, that promoting him? Do you know he's charging $400 first visit, giving you about 20 minutes of his time? I said, what? So, sure enough, he did that. And I called him and I said, what's this I hear about you charging all this money for the first? Well, you know, Gary, you know, I had to move to a Park Avenue office and, you know, the staff, and it's so expensive. And I said, but you broke your word. Well, you know, I mean, now you're well known and you're just exploiting people. He said, well, you know, no, I give good care. It's just that, you know, you've got greed. That's what you have. Unfortunately, his karma came back to meet him in this lifetime. In any case, we need to tell the holistic doctors and clinicians, be ethical, be decent, be compassionate. And you have to insist upon that. In any case, what I found was that only when we did it right, meaning a good diet, an excellent diet, high in living nutrients, phytochemicals, antioxidants, full spectrum of nutrients, and we exercised every day, and for an hour, and resistance exercise, and we did de-stressing, things like yoga, meditation, deep breathing, and energy work, and we had a clean environment or cleaned up our personal work environment, made it green, and when we developed nurturing relationships, and when we extended the energy to help others in the society by balancing our spiritual energy, by helping for others, then we lived a longer life. Then we changed the message of the DNA, and lo and behold, diseases that otherwise we would have succumbed to in injury, pain, or suffering, or death, we were able to improve or reverse quality of life factors. And then I found that when you enhance even more phytonutrients, more antioxidants, you take it above what the DNA damage is. And there's where this critical new whole mindset is, that is just now starting to permeate some of the people out there, that a certain level of input helps maintain the integrity of your DNA, but when you exceed that, in other words, when you give more of something that's healing to a cell that's been damaged by virus, bacteria, trauma, parasites, electromagnetic pollution, you not just protect it, you actually rejuvenate it. You give it a whole new life and a whole new meaning. And that's what I call the laws of compensation. We just have never had a culture where we've exceeded what was expected, because the official holistic health, the official orthodox health is the diet's enough. It is not. So those people say, gee whiz, you keep mentioning other nutrients, you know, like alpha-lipoic acid, which reverses mitochondrial decay at 900 milligrams. Can I get it in a food? No. No, you can't. It's just another piece of the puzzle. How many pieces are there? Thousands? So you do what you can, the best you can, with the most important pieces. De-stressing, a big piece. Quality of life values, what do you value? And are they harmonizing with true universal values? Humongous piece. Physical activity, big piece. Quality diet, outstanding piece. Nutrients, Very important piece. But clearly, very few people can do everything. So do the best you can with all that you have. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Every day, it's getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. Every day, it's getting faster. Everyone said, go ahead and ask her.
Music from the 1950s, just sharing some older sounds for those of you who were around and appreciated them. This week, our issue of the day, and then I'm going to go to our guest while you're thinking about this issue, and then I will come back later after our guest to take your calls, and I'll give you our number in a second. This is from Joyce Biasso from Global Research. It's short, but it's very important. Quote, suppose that one day a foreign investor decided to buy a vast tract of fertile land in the United States. Suppose all that is grown or produced on that land and all the profits made would be shipped directly overseas. Worse, imagine that those Americans who had been living off that land for decades, maybe centuries, would be forced to move and given little to no compensation. Such an event would undoubtedly spark public outrage, yet this scenario is not far from reality. Only the roles are reversed. American companies have recently begun investing heavily in foreign land, and many involved in the worldwide struggle against hunger believe that it is a cause for concern, myself included. What the investors wrapped in that beautiful Clinton-esque agricultural development? No, it's grubby land grabbing, and that creates food insecurity. Land grabbing is not new. In fact, it's recently been practiced on a greater scale. In fact, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations estimates that 75,000 square miles have been acquired by foreign interests in Africa alone. That's a big bunch of land. In fact, in some countries, as much as 20% of the entire country is now owned by outsiders, and they can really play down and dirty, like Dominion Farms, which bought swampland in Kenya to turn it into rice plantations, has reportedly intentionally flooded local farms to force the relocation of those farmers. And despite promises of jobs and increasing food production and food and foreign investment, hardly any of that happens. Nothing benefits the local communities because its aim is to secure crops and profits from those back home to the investors. So they'll tell you we're responsible about land development, and I'll say you're lying. You don't have to live on the land that you're taking away, but others do. What do you do? How do they get them off the land? What if you have thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of people on the land? Simply, you go there with the armed forces, and you say you move or we'll kill you. It's that simple. That's what they do. Is this known to the people and the hedge funds and the Clintons and others? Oh, yes, fully known. They're fully aware that whatever it takes to get their land, they will get it. And at the end, they applaud themselves because of two reasons. A, they can now keep that land fallow, which then can force up the price of food until that food is needed. Then they can grow it and control the price. They could charge three times what otherwise would be charged on the worldwide market because they control supply and demand. Who are the biggest players? The Chinese. The Chinese have literally a whole new colonization. Isn't that unethical? Of course it's unethical. Well, shouldn't the State Department, Hillary Clinton, No, they're not going to say anything about anything that China's doing, even though China's the new colonial power. China is the new France, Belgium, and England, all in one, in Africa. They're the largest land grabbers. They have the cash. They can buy the land. They have the technocrats. And that's what they're doing. I see. So it doesn't matter, Democrat, Republican, it's all irrelevant. It's just taking away land from people and giving it to corporations for just one more way of making extra profit. That's how it works. Your thoughts. It's happening. It's not a myth, but you don't hear it talked about because the moment you start talking about it, someone is going to be in the spotlight. And we don't like political donors in the spotlight. It embarrasses them. Your thoughts on this, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, that's our issue of the day. Land grabbing by American corporations and hedge funds and equity partnerships and everybody else who wants to make a lot of money. And by the way, they can actually borrow the money through the Federal Reserve at zero interest and buy up all they want. So the greatest debt creators in the world today, the greatest debt creators, are creating debt from money that they got for free, 0.2%, that's zero, from the Federal Reserve, guaranteed by the American public. So you and I, we don't get a break. You and I, as small business owners, we can't get a loan. You and I, as taxpayers, we can't have our house protected with a moratorium on home foreclosures. You and I cannot stop jobs from being exported out of the United States. You and I cannot get massive waste on the part of the state, federal, and local governments with redundancy and corruption and cronyism and nepotism and multiple contracts given for the same one job. You and I can't cut back any of this. You and I have no representation. It's a fraud. But man, people in power, they have the Federal Reserve. And that's a big friend to have. Your thoughts, please. Let's go over and say hello to my guests who are standing by. Nice to have you with us today, Lawrence Larry Joseph, a seasoned investigative journalist, a science writer on nature, politics for over a quarter century, New York Times, Discovery, Huffington Post, and the author of Aftermath, The Guide to Preparing for and Surviving Apocalypse 2012.
Thanks for having me, Gary.
And also Kevin Camps. Kevin Camps from Tacoma Park, Maryland. He's a specialist in radioactive waste storage and nuclear facility operations for Beyond Nuclear, a nonprofit organization opposing nuclear power and weapons and advocating for safeguarding our future. And he is among the experts that appear in Knocking on the Devil's Door. Nice to have you with us today, Kevin.
Thank you, Gary.
Okay, here's the larger issue. I'm going to start with you, if you would, please, Lawrence, to lay this out. We have been led to believe that there is nothing in the United States that could really happen to any of our 104 operating nuclear facilities that would cause, unless it's a terrorist attack, that would cause a meltdown or anything representing an acute public health alert. And then I'm thinking, well, hold on a second. What about the unique solar flares? We get solar flares regularly, but I'm talking about the ones that are coming in about a year or so. And now that NASA is the one who told us that there is a hole in our magnetic belt five times wider than the planet Earth, they flew five satellites through it, and that means that the solar flares will hit the Earth at a greater intensity than previously, and that could fry out and destroy many of the substations and major power grids, which then feed the nuclear facilities, which means that they would go on backup supply for however long that is, and generally that's only as long as their backup fuel, if those work at all. And then after that, then what is the scenario for a possible meltdown on one of these facilities? Could you take us through this, please, step by step?
Well, I can certainly try. We are vulnerable in ways that we had never imagined, or at least that those who would dare to imagine it out loud were dismissed. But in December 2008, the National Academy of Sciences, in collaboration with NASA, issued a report on the potential threat from severe space weather, from basically what are called coronal mass ejections, explosions that issue from the sun, crash through our protective magnetic field, and short out our electrical power grid. According to that report, up to 130 million Americans could be without power for months or years. Months or years. If we are hit by a solar blast the size of at least three that we've gotten in the last 150 years, 1859, 1909, and 1921. So if and it's going to happen. I mean, there's no indication that the sun just went through an extraordinary, strange phase those three times and is never going to do it again. So aside from everything else, the fact that knocking out the electrical power grid would take away our food and our fuel and even our water in many cases because the pumps are electric, no refrigeration, little or no banking, law enforcement, military security. To stick to the topic today, it's important to remember that the power grid supplies electricity to nuclear plants, which they need to run. I mean, they do not, they're not self-contained, hermetically sealed entities. They need energy inputs from outside. For example, there's a nuclear plant I was just reading about in Virginia that gets its power from a conventional plant in Ohio. Well, you unplug the nuclear plant in Virginia from the plant from the conventional plant in Ohio, and you are, as you had mentioned, Gary, operating on backup reserve, which can last. It depends on a lot of things, and I cannot speak authoritatively certainly about any particular plant. But let's say, to be optimistic, prayerfully optimistic, a month. So you'd say, okay, in a month they can get those utility crews out there and fix things up. But again, the National Academy of Sciences says we will be without electricity should one of these solar blasts hit for months or years. And there's a very good reason for that. It's not just, you know, picking a number out of the sky. The transformers, which are the weak links of the power grid, are what get blown when these solar blasts hit. We had it happen in 1989, also 2003. The transformers get fried, and you cannot go out and just fix a transformer. Their copper windings get fused solid. You need to replace them. The world market, the average waiting list in the world market for these transformers, for the largest ones, the most important ones that really hold the grid together, is about 3 years waiting list. None of these, by the way, are made in the United States anymore. And you can't just have a crash campaign of stockpiling and say, okay, here's the threat. Let's go and commission India or Brazil or whoever's has the best production capability to build, say, 1,000 of them and stick them in a warehouse somewhere. For one thing, there are over 100 tons apiece, but more importantly, each one has to be calibrated very precisely to its input and output, to its position along the grid. So you can't mass produce and then plug them in like you would a Lego toy. So if we have no electricity flowing to our nuclear plants and they use up their backup fuel, which they eventually will, I think the best average guess is in about a month or so, you could have a string of what I think it might be about 140 nuclear plants across the country. The other guests will know better than I, I'm sure, going off like a string of Chernobyls. Not an optimal scenario.
Okay. We have to assume that since this would hit the northern band of the world, not just the United States, we would not be the only country affected by solar flares, that China could also be affected. And since it has 16 of the world's largest 25 cities, they would also be needing these backup generators that they make. So therefore, what is the likelihood that if they're also equally affected, that they're going to sell us their generators when their own populations would need them?
It's an excellent point, although I must say that the United States finds itself singularly vulnerable in all this. The closer a country is or territory is to the poles, either north or south, the more vulnerable they are because the Earth's magnetic field is weakest at the poles. So the northeastern, midwestern, and northwestern part of the United States are particularly vulnerable, not only because of their proximity to the pole, but also because we rely on very high voltage transformers, higher, for example, than Western Europe does, higher than countries of the same latitude. China has the geographical good luck of being somewhat further south and therefore a little less vulnerable, but your point still obtains because, you know, I mean, just because they happen to be a few degrees latitude more south in general doesn't mean that they're going to be spared completely or even largely. And all of a sudden, Transformers have become a political and economic weapon, a very powerful one. And who knows what they might do, out of their own self-interest or out of greed.
All right, let's take it one step further. In Fukushima, we found out that it was not the tsunami that caused the biggest damage. It was the earthquake itself, and it was not an 8.1 hit because it was 150 miles away from the epicenter. It was closer to a 7.5, and therefore the backup generators didn't work. So we have the same malfunctioning capacity for backup generators. In fact, it was Graydon Pallas who found in an investigation that he was the chief prosecutorial investigator that a lot of the test records for safety on these backup generators were falsified. Instead of running them for 5 days on just the backup generators, they were being run for an hour and then falsifying the documents. They were found guilty and fined an enormous fine, but it didn't change anything. The same companies, the same people were out there, so we're assuming the assumption that if there is a blackout, that these backup generators will last for a month. We have no assurance of that because none have been tested for a month, not one.
That's an extraordinarily good and depressing point. And I'm sure you're right. I'm sure that there have been a lot of papers initialed in all the proper places and reports given and shelved, and generators that have crud and soot in them or that have rusted through or something equally negligent. And I had never thought about that, never put that together. And I want to thank you for sobering me up at this early hour. I'm on the West Coast. It's 9 o'clock. I'm going to be in a funk until at least noon.
Sorry, Lawrence. One other point I'd like to make. Let us assume for a moment that your scenario, that we are going to get hit, that is not in dispute. I've read at least 30 articles from scientists and astrophysicists. They agree upon that. It is the degree of severity of the consequences of the hit that they're all in different states of contention about. But let's just say that we don't go to the furthest extreme and we don't go to the furthest in denial that anything will happen. Let's go somewhere in the middle where we do have power outages, but not for years, let's just say for a month in the major cities. If we had power outage for a month in the major cities, during that period of time, there's a high probability that Indian Point would have a meltdown. How would anyone know that there was a problem with Indian Point? Because there would be no electricity. There'd be no cell phones, telephones, computers. There'd be no way to communicate to the public the severity of the problem, nor when help is on the way. People are not going to have backup storage for food for a month or water for a month. You couldn't use your toilet, couldn't use a gas station, because these are all based upon electrical pumps, electrical water pump, electrical gas pump. So therefore, people are waiting each day with the hope that today's the day that there's going to be the lights come on. No one's thinking about a nuclear power plant. No one's thinking that it could explode. First, unlike Fukushima that did explode, and we have photographs of it exploding, it was hardly heard. It was very low velocity as far as the sound of it, and then you don't see it. You don't see radiation, you don't smell radiation, and you don't feel it initially. But now let's just say hypothetically that after 30 days or 45 days, the Indian Point runs out of its backup diesel and its backup generator, and at 59 hours later the water goes out of the spent fuel rods and there is an explosion. No one would know. At miles per hour, 12.2 miles per hour, the wind traveling as it normally does out of New York South, in 3 hours you have 20 million Americans who have been hit with radiation. That we don't know how much radiation because no one's measuring it, and we don't see it. We don't know what to do. There's no evacuation plans at all. What happens if that scenario occurs, and do you believe that even theoretically, with what you're predicting, could that be something we would consider in the realms of probability?
I firmly believe that it's a matter of when, not if. I firmly believe that. I mean, you touched lightly on the fact about how the Earth's magnetic field is showing serious signs of depletion. And you know, when I first heard about this, I thought, oh my gosh, it's just another one of the things that people like to wring their hands about and fret over. But fact of the matter is that FEMIS, a squadron of five, count them, five NASA solar spacecraft, flew through a pole to equator hole in the Earth's magnetic field. And the lead scientist on the project exclaimed that it was as shocking, it was as though the sun rose in the west, how surprised they were at this eventuality. And, you know, from Star Trek, the shields are down, Scotty. And scientists now believe in general that pole shifts happen with some frequency. I've seen estimates from 70,000 years to 750,000 years. They don't know. But they know it happens. And they know that once it starts, it takes a couple thousand years to complete. In the grand scheme of things, it probably contributes to our evolutionary well-being. You know, that's part of the process, and the radiation causes mutations, which hasten evolution, all that stuff, fine. But right now, we're a society completely, a civilization completely dependent on our interconnectedness. And with the magnetic field going down and our power grids vulnerable and as you say, our communication dependent upon it, we couldn't be in a more susceptible situation. It's what I call the paradox of progress. The farther we advance, the more we dependent we become on our advances, and we're going to get bit hard. And I can't say when, but I'll tell you, the next solar climax, it's a consensus of astronomers, is going to come late 2012 or early 2013. That's the next red zone. That's the next probable time of getting hit by one of these blasts and knocked either slightly or knocked silly.
Okay, well, let me just give you my final thoughts. I believe that we as a society must go proactive and insist to our legislators in Washington, the President of the United States, that this becomes the number one priority to get surge protectors on all the substations and all the main stations. That's a total of about 10,300 from my count. These can run anywhere from $55,000 to $80,000, a relatively small amount of money. The House of Representatives is aware of this issue and doesn't have a problem with it. The industry does have a problem, and I don't see why, because it's a small amount of money to pay for something that would protect them and us. And yet this is not in the news. It's not in anyone's talking points. You don't hear a word about it except on a program like this. If we do not do something and this happens, the low end is within 6 months you could have 30 million dead Americans who are in those areas where nuclear would go offline and explode. There'd be no way to clean up the mess because the tools necessary to contain radiation leaks are not going to be there, because where's the electricity going to come for the emergency generators and for all the equipment necessary to make the repairs? Your final thoughts, please.
Well, I wrote a New York Times op-ed piece on this very subject a year ago and was astonished to learn that the U.S. House of Representatives had voted unanimously to take the steps to put surge suppressors around the grid. And those folks won't cross the aisle to perform the Heimlich maneuver, yet somehow they came together on this, I was proud to say. But then the Senate, the corresponding bill in the Senate, the language regarding utilities was stripped right out, gone, no mention of protecting the grid from solar blasts. So whatever bizarre machinations are going on there, I mean, it's very important and dispiriting as well to try to figure out what's going on behind the scenes. But someone's taking this very seriously at the very highest levels. I was at a meeting at Parliament in London, a 19-nation summit. Everyone was pledged not to discuss what they heard there. So the only thing I can say is pray. Pray. Even if you don't believe, pray.
Huh. Is this the same prayer that people will give at Nagasaki, Hiroshima, May Lai, the World Trade Towers? Is this the same prayer we should do here, Larry?
Do whatever prayer makes you feel closest to the Almighty, and if there is no Almighty...
Well, then you're going to be close to the Almighty. All right. Thank you very much, Larry. I appreciate your good work.
Sure enough. Thank you for having me.
Larry Joseph, a multi-award-winning investigative journalist from Science, Nature, New York Times, telling us the bad news that nobody wants to hear. Nobody wants to hear it. And I'm telling you, you better hear it. And let's go over now and say hello to Kevin. Kevin, nice to have you with us. Kevin, I'm going to ask you to hold your thoughts for just a moment, all right?
Okay.
Because we have in studio a couple of the people in my office who've been working tirelessly on some documentaries. Kevin, by the way, is in the film, my new film, called Knocking on the Devil's Door. Have you had a chance to see Knocking on the Devil's Door, Kevin?
Yes, it's very powerful.
Okay. Here's what we're doing, Kevin. Today, we have mailed out, I think, 27,000 copies of the film with a press release to all members of state legislatures and 1,200 environmental journalists and 1,000 media celebrities and 420 environmental groups around. I mean, we're mailing it all over the place just to make people aware, because we're going to try one thing only. Consolidate our effort and focus so we're not disparate on closing Indian Point. If we can close Indian Point, we can close every nuclear facility. And we do have one member of the House of the legislature in New York that is the representative from the area of Three Mile Island, of Indian Point, who was at the screening in New York. And we're going to put our energy there. And we're bringing in on September 21st at 7 p.m. And I'd like, if you can be there, please, Kevin, be there so we can have you.
Yeah, I plan on it.
Good, because I want to introduce you to this from the podium. We're going to be sold out. The rafters won't be able to hold all the people. And this is the Ethical Culture Center. Have you ever been there?
I have not.
It's magnificent. It was built back at the beginning of the century. It's this humongous room, holds almost 1,000 people. We'll be having Vandana Shiva, Greg Palast, Carl Grossman, yourself, a whole panel of people talking about, for almost 2 hours, talking about the solutions that we need to implement individually. Everyone who comes will get a free copy of Knocking on the Devil's Door. And so we want to galvanize worldwide. We're going to have it around the world on televisions and computers. And then we're going to take a 10-minute break at the end of this. There'll be panel questions and answers. And all the different activist groups are going to be there with tables set up and literature handed out. So it'll be everyone we can possibly get worldwide who wants to see us go anti-nuclear. We're going to start with closing down Indian Point. From there, we go out to the other facilities in California, Connecticut, New Jersey. From there, we go to around the world. From there, we go to deconstructing our nuclear arsenals, etc. Anyhow, that's going to happen on September 21st, 7 p.m., Ethical Culture Center. Then I'm going to do something I've never done before. I'm going to bring in an entirely separate film. I'm going to give them Knocking on the Devil's Door as my gift for being there. Then we're going to take a 10-minute break at the end of this two-hour presentation. Then we're going to show in its entirety a brand-new feature film that's already won or got official finalists in 50 international film festivals this year, Death by Medicine, the most searing, comprehensive look at what's wrong with medicine and how to fix it. From everyone in it is a part of the Orthodox medical community, professors of medicine. It took me 6 years to film this. And it's done now. It just so happens they're both coming out at the same time. Rather than a month now having a separate showing, I'm going to show it that night so people get a double dose of activism, how to protect their life, save their life. And I'm also going to introduce the ethical holistic physicians, many of them who are not, but holistic dentists, nurses, chiropractors, osteopaths, homeopaths. I have all those people who will be there, so at least there'll be an acknowledgement that that medicine has to change, and on its own it will not. And we don't even have a healthcare system of any value in our society except for emergency healthcare, which is exemplary and I commend, but everything else fails. So that film, Death by Medicine, will follow our nuclear challenge. So we have two things same night. It's a long night. I've rented the whole Ethical Center for the whole night. So we have no rushing on getting out of there. And then I'll have a Q&A after that as well. And joining me in studio real quick is Richard Polonesky. He's the chief of our film division of making our documentaries. We currently have 16 documentaries in production. That's where I'm at right now. I'm traveling, filming every single day. Hi, Richard.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Good. Richard, could you give people just a little sample of Knocking, Death by Medicine, the film that we're going to show on the same night that we're going to talk, the first 2 hours we're going to do this, and Valerie, who is our frontline executive producer and also co-director on Death by Medicine and Knocking on the Devil's Door, both. She's there day and night, weekends. I can't get her to go home. And she is just dedicated as an activist on this. Hi, Val.
Hi, Gary.
So we're going to have a double evening, the most comprehensive activist social moving media evening imaginable. From 7 till 9, it's Knocking on the Devil's Door discussion panelists, Vandana Shiva, all these great people, including Kevin Camps, who's on the line now. Everyone will get a copy of the film. You'll watch the film at home. Then we take a 10-minute break. Then we watch, in its entirety, the first and only premiere. There won't be any other premieres of Death by Medicine, and this could save your lives. And this is the film that people need to see. And then I'll give them a copy of Death by Medicine and the book, which is coming out the week before Death by Medicine. Again, is my gifts. All this for $25. People want to come, call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. Now, some stations are going to... Matt, my engineer, let's just do 2 minutes. Let's just hear a clip from Death by Medicine.
What do we need? Where do we need it?
We are really in a dire situation. Republican or Democrat, it steams along. This government is dominated by the pharmaceutical industry. And if it wants a drug approved, it will get it, regardless of the consequences to the American people.
When 50% of America has a chronic disease, something's wrong. It means we failed at our health care system. It means we have a disease care system.
Well, I don't think the public has begun to grasp the stranglehold of the pharmaceutical industry and the health insurance industry and the for-profit hospital industry and the nursing homes.
Drugs that have been said to be too unsafe to approve by the FDA's own medical reviewers have been approved over their objections and entered into the market, causing the very harms they predicted.
The FDA, in my opinion, has probably killed more Americans in this country than all the wars that the U.S. has ever fought combined.
The drugs themselves cause death, disability, further symptoms, which typically are further treated with other drugs.
As an ethical issue, they never think, gee, this is going to kill people, I shouldn't do it.
The pharmaceutical companies have one objective. That is not the health and safety of the individuals in this country, but the almighty dollar. The bottom line, making a buck.
They're going to become chronically ill. They're going to become chronically depressed. That's the expected end. And that's why they will need to be on these drugs for life. We're not killing them quickly, but we're taking their lives away.
The FDA approves unsafe medical devices, unsafe prescription drugs that harm Americans. And they spend any extra energy they have after approving drugs to go after natural product manufacturers to make sure that there is no competition to their clients, the pharmaceutical industry.
One of the oldest activities in the world is...
That's just 2 minutes out of an hour and a half film that's currently the number one winning documentary in the world on in documentaries. And we're going to show that one night only, the only night, the only premiere in New York, September 21st, 8 p.m., Ethical Culture Center. You'll get a copy of the film. You'll also get a copy of Knocking on the Devil's Door and a copy of my new book. You're getting $90 with a value because I want everyone to be able to afford it and come away with an enormous amount of proactive information. Call 877-627-5065. I expect us to have 1,000 seats sold today, 877-627-5065. I'm going to come back to Val and come back to Richard. And for the stations who are going offline in a moment, thank you very much for being with us today. If you want to continue listening to the rest of this program, go to progressiveradionetwork.com, progressiveradionetwork.com. That's where 98% of the people listen to it anyhow. Now, Kevin, over to you. Tell us from your perspective what you see the challenges for us involving the lies of the nuclear industry, the legislators they control, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which they control, the media, which they can control. Tell us from your perspective, what you see the problem and the solutions to be.
Yeah, you and your earlier guests really hit on some important points about the fragility of the nuclear power industry, not only in the United States, but in other countries. Certainly, Fukushima Daiichi, the nuclear catastrophe that is ongoing now for almost 6 months, is a real case in point. The earthquake, as you said, they've tried to cover this up as best they can. The earthquake, which was a 9.0, but some distance from Fukushima Daiichi, seems to have done tremendous damage to the plant alone without the tsunami. The tsunami hit about an hour later, and what the tsunami was able to accomplish was the earthquake knocked out the electrical grid, the primary source of electricity for running the safety systems and the cooling systems. The tsunami, an hour later, whatever was left of the cooling and safety systems was wiped out by the tsunami. And what that did was through that plant with three operating reactors that day, fortunately the other three were not operating, it threw that plant onto its emergency backup battery supply, which in Japan is 8 hours. In the United States, most plants are 4 hours of backup battery. And after the end of that 8 hours, at the latest, the meltdowns were in full swing. There was nothing left to cool the cores with. And in fact, the earthquake damage was probably enough to cause the first meltdown at Unit 1. The official version even admits a five-hour time period is all it took for that first meltdown. So it's a very fragile electricity source, that's putting it mildly, because catastrophes can explode and release catastrophic amounts of radioactivity. That is a global catastrophe, not just for the Fukushima prefecture, but really for all of Japan and for many other countries. Of course, North America is both downwind and downstream of Fukushima Daiichi, so we are catching fallout in various ways, including through the food supply, through the food chain. And like you said, the industry is very powerful, one of the most powerful industries in the United States. Just to give folks an idea, from 1999 to 2009, this industry spent $645 million on lobbying at federal level. That's more than $1 million per week. And my joke is that I know what that feels like. I didn't know until about a year ago the figure of how much money, but I sure knew what it felt like trying to counter it as an anti-nuclear activist. So yes, they do own the Republican Party almost to a member. They own way too much of the Democratic Party. Way too many Democrats are pro-nuclear power. And there are, fortunately, great exceptions like Ed Markey of Western Massachusetts in the U.S. House, a very senior member of the relevant committees over nuclear safety. He just did a study in recent months after Fukushima showing how often the emergency diesel generators in the United States have failed. The figure is 74 diesel generator failures in the past 8 years. The most recent one, as your previous guest mentioned, the earthquake near the North Anna Nuclear Power Plant in Virginia. Three of the four emergency diesel generators did fire up when the grid went down, but one of them didn't. So yet again, a 25% failure rate. Luckily, the other three were working, were able to keep cooling the core, the pool containing high-level radioactive waste. The risks are tremendous. The industry takes these risks because they have externalized the costs and the liabilities onto the public.
I appreciate those insights, Kevin. We look forward to seeing you at the September 21st rally, lecture, forum, film showing of Knocking on the Devil's Door and Death by Medicine. You'll be joined by Vandana Shiva, Greg Palast, a whole panel of individuals. All of you are working diligently every day. With Beyond Nuclear, a nonprofit organization opposing nuclear power and weapons and advocating for safeguarding our future. I look forward to seeing you then.
Thank you for the film and for organizing the event.
Well, that's what we're going to do. We have to be proactive. That's what progressives do. They look for solutions. They're honest about the problem. And what can we do to get out of everyone that we can out of harm's way? Do not take anything for granted. Do not assume because the 5.8 earthquake didn't cause catastrophic problems that we won't have a bigger one that will. Because if we do have a bigger one, which I believe we will, then what are you going to do when the radiation comes at you? There is nothing you can do at that point. Final thoughts from Richard Polonesky, and anything you'd like to add in here, please do, Valerie. Valerie, we'll start with you.
Well, I'm just hoping everyone comes out. We've been talking to people from all over the world, from Germany, Japan, France. They're coming in anyway for a wonderful conference at the UN about nuclear power, and they're going to be at this event, and I think it's going to be really important. It's going to take us to another level, and we're going to really do something this time.
You're aware that the leading anti-nuclear activists in all of Japan are coming, right?
Absolutely, yes.
We have the whole front row, I think 40 seats just for them. When you come that far, we're going to do all we can to accommodate that, you make sure that you see our message, and we're unifying. This is the first time from Japan, from all over the world, we're all unifying. This is not political. This is about our health and our future. And so thank you for all the good work you've done with all those hours and Peter and everyone working on this film. And let's say final thoughts over to you, Richard Polonesky.
Absolutely, Gary. Well, this is, it's such a rare opportunity to see so many incredibly gifted people who are on the fight to help prevent any of these catastrophes from nuclear plants and radiation, and to have such a rare opportunity to see these people all together at one time, sharing their views, inspiring, and then not to mention that, but literally, I mean, this is a veritable bargain when you factor in the panel discussion, the premiere of the incredible film Death by Medicine, and everyone taking home a DVD of Knocking on the Devil's Door, a DVD of Death by Medicine, and a book for Death by Medicine, all for $25. You're not going to find a deal like that anywhere in New York City.
Well, it's not. It's all going to be expensed. There are no profits. There are lots of losses. I'm willing to absorb those losses. I'm paying for all this myself, because I believe it's time that we progressives got together and showed all the people on the left or right how to do something that benefits all of humanity without political divisions, without exclusion, and to get the job done. Our job is to close in the end point, and there's a lot of us. We're not a few people. We are millions, tens of millions of people. So we're going to show that we can do something organized in a positive way to help protect our future and to help protect us now, because the solar flares are coming. I've warned everyone, I would not be in the New York area when the solar flares come under any circumstances. But I also warned you to get generators. You didn't. Get backup food. You didn't. To get currencies, junk silver and gold and cash. Most didn't. Everybody thought, what's the big deal? I don't hear Keith Oman. I don't hear Rich Mutton. I don't hear anyone talking about it. So it can't be an issue. Oh, yes, it's an issue. But they're afraid to talk about it, because then they wouldn't be on the right side of the issues. Thank you all very much for listening. I look forward to sharing more. And by the way, you can download and listen now to Monday night's powerful program, 1 hour on the truth behind 9/11. Go to progressiveradionetwork.com, go to the archives, and go to the Progressive Commentary Hour for Monday night, 7 p.m., and listen in and join 62,000 other people who did. It's important information you need to have. Have a nice day.
The show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tappenfeld.